Today's guest wants us to spend some quality time taking a look at our lives with more intentionality. Today's guest is Dr. Eric L. Johnson. Dr. Johnson wants us to take a look beyond self-help and pay attention to the journey of being better. Dr. Johnson, tell us what you mean by that.
Well, my piece, Beyond Self-Help, is a self-exploration book that invites us to take stock in the context and take stock of our lives in the context of three questions. One, who we are, who we have been, and who we strive to be.
Who we are, who we have been, and who we strive to be.
Indeed.
I can think about half a million people who truly don't want to go there.
Absolutely. I think you underestimate the number.
Okay, I may. Well, let's start with your beginnings. Tell
sure.
us where you were born and what your early life experiences were like.
That's really a good question. So I was born and raised in Chicago.
Okay.
And by the time I was 8 years old, well, maybe nine or so, I was in a gang.
You were in a gang at nine?
At nine. By the time I was 11 or 12, I owned a gun. By the time I was 15 or 16, my oldest son was born. And so right around that time, I dropped out of school because mm-hmm. I thought there were more important things for me to do than get an education.
Right.
And so it's been quite a journey for me.
Well, let's kind of just go back to where you just started from. At nine
okay.
years old, you were in a gang.
Sure.
What did that mean for your day-to-day life?
Wow. It meant different things on different days, but it almost always involved some sort of participating, witnessing, avoiding some sort of violent act per day.
Every day.
Every single day. I lived about seven blocks, my house was about seven blocks from my elementary school. And so that seven blocks was treacherous because we had to go through another gang's territory to go from home to school. And that was a journey every day, twice a day.
And when you say that it was treacherous, for those who don't have a frame of reference for that, you're not talking about you had to look each way to make sure you didn't get hit by a car.
Absolutely. Although that's helpful not to do that too.
That's true. but what did that mean for you, those treacherous seven blocks?
Yeah, so for example, I was always aware of who was on the porch of houses as I walked by them.
Okay.
I was always aware of who was behind me. I was always aware of who was in front of me, how far I needed to go, what side of the street I was on, what colors people were wearing as they were riding by me in cars. My awareness of my environment was not unlike the Giselle's awareness of the lion and the tiger in the wild.
And that's what it sounds like it felt like, too.
Indeed. It could, except for on the occasion when I was the lion.
Now, when you were the lion, was that around the time that a gun showed up in your life?
Indeed.
And how did that happen? I mean, you were a teenager. How'd you get a gun?
You know, at that time, now even today, I would imagine that guns are even more available to young people
yeah.
than they were when I was growing up.
Mm-hmm.
But, through the gang networks, there was always opportunities for people to come buy guns. Now, unlike today, when I was a youth, everybody didn't have a gun. It was maybe two or three in the group, and then we moved those guns around.
I see.
But unlike today, where each individual kid in the gang has guns,
mm-hmm.
it wasn't quite that.
Okay. Heavy. But you had a gun, and you were a teenager.
One. Yes, I was. I was moving up in leadership, and so I was.
And as you were moving up in leadership in the gang, you didn't feel like you needed to go to school because school wasn't teaching you anything.
Absolutely. Well, not anything that I thought was germane to my particular journey at the
Okay.
time. No.
And where was the rest of your family? Who was in your family?
So at that time, my father had just passed away.
Oh, boy.
And my mother was doing the best she could, trying to make sense of her life after her husband passing. She had never worked. And so, you know, there were times where it was so cold inside the house that I lived in. I'm talking inside my house now, that the water in the commode was frozen.
Wow.
That's inside the house.
Gotcha.
Sure.
So it was a very, very difficult time for you and your mom. Any siblings?
Yeah, I have a younger brother and a younger sister. My sister didn't grow up with us. She grew up with my grandmother in Ohio, but my younger brother absolutely did. Sure.
And was he aware of the fact that you were part of a gang?
Yes. I mean, and I was, you know, for a while there, I thought he was following, you know, it's Big Brother, so you want to follow
right.
Big Brother's footsteps.
Exactly.
But prayerfully, he didn't. He did not follow my footsteps. My mother left Chicago when he was very young.
Okay.
I joined the service. I joined the Navy, and my younger brother was about, I don't know, 11. I joined the service. I was 17, so he's
okay.
probably 12, 11, 12, 13 in that area. And she left Chicago, and I think that was probably the best decision she ever made.
Now, you joined the service at 17. You became a dad at, you said, 15 or 16?
Yeah. So my son was. Well, at least a year old when I joined. He may have been a year and a half to 2 years old, somewhere in there. The exact times escaped me, but he was at least a year old when I joined the service. He was one of the reasons that I joined the service.
How so?
Because there was some reality I was becoming painfully aware of some realities, and that was that I was responsible for somebody else's well-being.
Mm-hmm.
And I had begun to think about what I was currently doing probably wasn't the best situation. Now, people would be surprised to hear, and maybe you're familiar with this, but there was a time not that long ago where when young men got into a fair amount of trouble, judges used to give them choices. Either you go to the local youth detention center
mm-hmm.
or you can join the service.
Mm-hmm.
That was quite commonplace 20, 30 years ago.
Okay.
And I found myself under those circumstances where just said, if you come back to me one more time, this is what I'm going to do.
Okay.
And so under those circumstances, I took the option of joining the service. Probably the best decision I ever made.
Gotcha. So in that case, the judge did you a favor.
I think most of the time it happens they were doing that.
Okay. Okay. Did your mom have any awareness of how much in jeopardy her little baby's life was in on a daily basis?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, she did what she could to intervene.
Yeah.
I mean, it wasn't absent her actively taking steps to intervene. In fact, when I joined the service, and I was kind of then vacillating on the decision to actually go, she sort of plotted and maneuvered with the recruiter to actually get me in one place at one time to get me off.
Okay.
Because she saw leaving as a way of saving my life.
Okay. And it sounds like you agree with her.
I do. I do. Not then, but I do now.
Got well then, yeah. What was that like for you? I mean, to go from, I mean, you were a man at the age of 9 in some respects, and in other respects, nowhere near a man. But
right. That's right.
Then you go from that and moving up in the gang to going into the military, where I don't think they give you lots of choices about how to behave.
Yes, they do not. And so for the first couple of years, that was a learning curve, because within the year and a half, what helped me was within a year and a half, the first Gulf War happened.
Mm.
So I joined in 88. We were in the Gulf at 90. And so you become aware of life and jeopardy in ways that it doesn't quite click for you.
Yeah.
In the urban streets, where you are now in some space where other people are paid money to try to kill you.
Mm-hmm.
Right. Another army. And so that was quite an awakening, quite an awareness that I'm not sure that that I would necessarily invite for others, but it is something that is that cannot be repeated and it cannot be replaced and it cannot be understated.
Is it very different from warring gangs, street gangs?
Yeah, you know, I've been asked that question before, and I don't know how to quite answer it because I do think it is different because of the familiarity of where you are and with the gang activity. Normally, gang activity is happening. You are even the players in the gang activity who are on the other side, who are dead setting, doing you harm. Most of those folks you do know.
I gotcha.
Right, okay. I mean, you've grown. Some of these young men you were in first grade with, you were in kindergarten with.
Okay,
you know, their big brothers play on the basketball team with your uncle or your cousin, right? And so, and then you're in an environment you're familiar with. War is completely different, where you're talking about strangers who are trained to do you harm in a place you've never been.
Right, and faces you don't know.
And so I think that those factors, I think that there's some things that, I think there's some elements of both that overlap. And I do, if this was a Venn diagram, there would be some areas that overlap and there would be some areas that would be separate.
Gotcha. While you were in the service, what was happening with your child and your child's mom?
Right. So we kept in touch. And so at that point, one of the things that, you know, the service did was they take an allotment out of your check and you send it to your son. I mean, to your children, to your family, whatever. And so we had established that. I would go back and forth from the service to Chicago, pick my son up, spend time with him. He would come down to Virginia with me. It was at that point I was learning to become a father.
Okay.
And in the ways that you do that beyond just providing money every month. And so in some ways, my son and I grew up together.
Well, yeah. I mean, you were a baby when you had a baby.
Yeah, indeed.
You dropped out of high school you dropped out of school at one point.
Yeah, around 15, 16, somewhere in there.
And today you have a PhD. Sounds to me like you went back to school.
Yeah, that's a heck of a journey, isn't it?
Indeed.
And it's not just that I find interesting. I ultimately, I spent about 10 years in public schools as in teacher roles and in administrative roles. And I like to credit several teachers who I think made a difference in my life, even though at the time I wasn't sure that I understood it. A man named Mr. Rubis in Chicago at my school, Raster Grammar School.
Mm-hmm.
He was the only teacher in my entire educational career who came to my house.
Wow.
He came. I wasn't coming to school for consistency. Around the time I was drifting off, he wasn't ultimately successful because I still went out and did what I did.
Uh-huh.
But he indicated to me that he cared,
okay.
And I listened to him as much as I had listened to any adult in my life to that point.
Gotcha. So he was
after
really.
I became a teacher. I found him. I went and found him online and let him know that
wonderful.
That what he did, the caring that he displayed, mattered to me, and it became part of my mission, my testimony, my drive to share that with other young people who need it.
And you know, I think so often, teachers don't realize necessarily how important they are in a child's life. But I think certainly as a society, we don't give teachers enough resources, credit, you name applause for
sure.
The work that they do, which can absolutely turn a child around, turn a child's entire life around. Dr. Johnson, we're going to take a break in a moment. When we come back, I'd like to go back to your experience in the Navy so you can just take us from being in the Navy to when you got out and what your first steps were when you came out. Was it the Navy you were in?
It was.
It was the Navy. Okay. All right. Folks, we're going to take a break, and when we come back, we will learn about Dr. Eric Johnson before he was Dr. Eric Johnson and getting out of the Navy. We'll be right back.
Thank you.
Dr. Johnson, take us to your leaving the Navy, and when you left the Navy, where did you go to? Where did you live after that?
Interesting question. You know, I don't think I've ever been asked that. So I left the Navy, and I went to Columbus, Ohio.
Okay.
I had a second daughter, and her mother was in Ohio, and we were trying to make a life. And so I went to Ohio to go to school, and I ultimately ended up going to Ohio State, which is where I got my 7 degrees. And so during that time,
all right, let's back up, because last time we talked, I didn't hear a high school diploma.
Right. So I ended up finishing high school barely.
Okay.
I ended up going back and finishing up high school because it was required for me to do that to join the service.
That's what I thought. Okay.
Yeah. So it was required. So I went back and finished high school. But I mean, that was, if there's anything ever done by the skin of your teeth, that was one of them.
Okay. Okay. They might have been as happy to see you leave as you were to go, it sounds like.
Oh, no question about
it. Okay. All right. So you get through high school, you're in the Navy, you're out of the Navy, you go to Ohio, and you've had another child.
I did, indeed.
Okay.
And so now I'm in school, and my son is going back and forth. Now, my son is in school, first grade, second grade, that. And so I'm going back and forth, and so we're driving from Ohio to Chicago on parent-teacher conference day. So several times we drove to Chicago, and we would be there for parent-teacher conference 20 minutes, and we'd get back in the car and drive back. But
wow.
It was that important to me to be that involved in his life. And so once he started school, he never had a teacher that I didn't meet.
You know, that is really extraordinary. I mean, you weren't living next door to him.
No.
And you weren't even within a few, you know, few minutes distance in terms of a drive, but you knew that it was important that he know his dad.
Absolutely. And I meant just the small things. I wanted him to know what flavor of Kool-Aid I liked, you know, that, I mean, I wanted him to be able to have the things about my dad that I never knew that I would have liked to have known.
Interesting. So you wanted him to see a real human being, a real person.
And particularly because my life was changing in a way. My life was changing, and I was concerned that he would only see the outcome and not the process.
Why was that important to you?
I didn't want him to see, you know, after I finished school and life was different, that this was all it had. This was what it had been for me.
Okay.
That there were. I wanted him to understand the journey that it took. One, so that he wouldn't have to repeat it, but also so that he could appreciate everything it meant for the benefits in his life.
What were some of your hopes for him as he was growing up, as you were growing up, and you had a daughter at that point?
Sure. It's funny because they have the same birthday.
That's interesting.
I don't know that I ever thought about. I still, these are conversations that he and I have all the time. In fact, we had one this morning.
Mm.
I never thought about it in terms of, you know, what profession I wanted him to work or what I thought I wanted him to do. I always thought about that in terms of the kind of human being I want to invite him to be.
Okay.
And so being a well-rounded, productive citizen, that's only piece of it. But I wanted him to begin to always, once I understood that it was important, to then participate in a journey that allows him to grow and become more and see each day as an opportunity to do something that he didn't do the day before.
Mm.
And I started thinking about that very early on in his life, probably around 10 or 11. And we started having conversations about life at 10, you know, we start talking about what it would be like if I wasn't around. For me, that was a very real conversation because I told you that my father passed away at 9, but that man was actually my mother's husband. He was not my biological father.
Okay.
I did not realize that until after he had passed away.
Huh.
I didn't meet my biological father until I was 35.
Wow.
But when you don't meet your biological father, that is a hole that is always there until it's filled. I don't, if you live to be 50 and you don't meet him, that's a hole that's never filled. I've been blessed enough to meet my biological father, and to close that hole. But so having, so all of the things that I, all of the ways in which I long to have a relationship with my father is the way in which I try to frame my relationship with my son.
And how about your relationship with your daughter?
And my daughter's the same way.
Okay.
Well, so what I've attempted to be, and so since I've written this book, Beyond Self-Help, I resist the notion of being positioned as a as an expert in this, because I think these are all things that we're all learning. These are all, we're all works in progress, and we're all trying to get better. And so this is just, so this is just me talking about this point in the journey for me. Right. And so you, I had mentioned my daughter because you hadn't asked me about her, but I have three daughters, and two of them, I was at the Air Force Academy for 4 years. And I'll give you a sense of my daughter. I was at the Air Force Academy for 4 years. We had, I was married for 15 years to their mother. We got divorced. So I went, took a job at the Air Force Academy. My daughter graduated from high school. She took a scholarship at Howard. When she graduated from high school, she was only 16.
All right, and that's Howard University
in
Washington,
D.C.
Okay.
She was only 16 when she graduated from high school.
Wow.
She asked me to, she thought 16 was too young to be in D.C. by herself. So she asked me to go. And I left the Air Force Academy and came to the DMV area with my daughter.
Wow.
For the rest of her life, she will know that she asked her father to come.
And he did.
And he came.
Right.
Absolutely. So as you asked me about my, I've been clear with all the professional things I've done, met with presidents, heads of states of other countries. The most important thing I would do while I was here, while I'm breathing, is be a good father to my children. Now, I'm sure I've fallen short in a lot of ways in that, but the intent was always there for me to do what I could do as I understood it.
When you, as we're talking about your commitment to your children, and certainly the book that you have written, I think, is actually the kind of book that many parents could share, not only for themselves, but certainly could share with them their children sort of as a template to really encourage being your best self. But in all of that, and in all of the things that you have gone through, there is the reality of Ferguson. There
Indeed.
Is the reality of Washington, D.C. and Virginia and pretty much every state, everywhere you go, where people of color, particularly young people of color, particularly men, young boys,
sure.
but not only, really don't seem to have a safe way to walk down the street. How do you talk to your children about that reality?
That is a very complicated question. In fact, I've been asked that about how I think my book relates to some of the, particularly in Chicago, some of the violence in Chicago is unprecedented. I mean, it's different than what it was when I was a youth.
Mm.
And
how?
I think that
how is it different?
Oh, I thought you were going to say something.
I did.
I think part of the complexity has to do with our young people don't have a sense of purpose. They don't have a. They're not being asked to think about why they're here and what their gifts are and what they're supposed to do while they're here. And I've spent most of my adult life in school, and while school, there are lots of things that schools do well, that is not one. So as you ask me a question about young people navigating and negotiating these very difficult and complicated environments, one of the things that we have to begin to examine within ourselves as a family unit is how much conversations do we have with our young people about their own sense of purpose.
Mm-hmm.
I was on a Black Lives Matter panel in Columbus, Ohio just a week ago.
Okay.
And one of the things that I said on the panel was that I think that Black Lives Matter is a great slogan that we should live by, but my only concern is that while we are expressing that to other communities, I'm not sure that's something that we think within our own community.
I see. So you are concerned not only for others as a whole, but for your children as individuals.
Absolutely. I think that all charity starts at home. So I can't go about the business of helping other young people if if I'm not first serving the needs of my own children? I think you have to start there.
Okay.
And so I like to think that I've had special relationships. I've made my children a priority in my life, even when other things weren't going as well as they probably could have. And I think that that communicated to them a sense of love that's important that young people have. I know that my mother meant well. I know that my mother did the best of what she could do with what she knew. But that sense of love was something that really sort of invited me to gang life.
Mm-hmm.
This sense of belonging, this sense of acceptance, that people don't understand that is a very intoxicatingly luring sense of
yeah.
being for young people. You can't, you're not really recruiting young people to go and do these incredibly violent things. They're being recruited to become part of a group. They're being
gotcha.
Recruited to belong, to be a part of something greater than themselves. And those elements, while they work in ways that negatively impact our young people, we can use those same principles to impact them in ways that are more positive.
The path that you took, which was sort of a jagged path.
Sure. Wow, you're being kind to me. I appreciate that. I appreciate that.
You like that? Sort of a jagged path.
Yeah, sure.
At some point, you, in addition to being a teacher and an administrator for nearly 10 years, somewhere in there, you went back to school again and again.
I did, indeed.
Why?
The short and simplest answer is that I really love learning. And school was a place that I could school was for me what some young men have in terms of the talent with the dribbling the basketball or
okay.
carrying the football. It was that place that I could go where I knew that I could do well. And it gave me a sense of purpose. And I was studying things that I mattered to me. I knew that I thought at that time I was going to be in the classroom for the rest of my career.
Okay.
And so I wanted to ensure that my time in the classroom, I could be as impactful to young people as I possibly could. Now, life has given me an opportunity to have a broader impact, and I'm certainly appreciative of that. But at the end of the day, there are times where I do miss seeing the kids every day.
Gotcha. We're going to take a break, but when we come back, I'd like to turn our focus more specifically to beyond self-help. Folks, this is Pamela Brewer, and you are listening to Mind Talk, and we'll be right back. Hello, folks. We're back and continuing the conversation with Dr. Eric Johnson. Now, you've heard Dr. Johnson talk about the fact that when he was a young one, dropped out of school, kind of wasn't his thing, and he really wasn't into school. I got to share a little bit more with you about his background. He currently serves as a chief consultant with Strategies to Succeed. He's the former chief of research publications for the United States Air Force Academy. He also served as the director of the Urban Education Program in the School of Education at Drake University. And for somebody who didn't particularly like school, he has earned 7 college degrees, 4 undergraduate and 3 graduate degrees, one of them being his PhD in education from Ohio State University. So you kind of went from not really liking school to being addicted to school.
I it's a place I spent most of my career, indeed.
And loving it, it sounds like.
I can't imagine doing anything different with my life.
Gotcha. Talk about your book, Beyond Self-Help, The Journey to Be Better. Self-help, in today's sort of lexicon, self-help is really popular. It's really the thing to do. But you're saying go beyond that.
Yeah, I try to do that title in part because there's some critiques I have about self-help, this sort of rah-rah, be your own best cheerleader type stuff. And my book is really not that. My book is really an opportunity for you to ask yourself some serious questions that most of us might not do so without prompting, and many of us won't do so even with prompting.
Right.
For example, one of the questions that my book asks is, what does my creator expect of me?
Mm-hmm.
How? I don't know that I can answer that question for you or anybody else. In fact, every day when I answer that question for myself, I get a different answer.
Gotcha.
And that's why I call it a journey. That getting to know ourselves is not a place that we visit. It's a journey that we go on, and that's completely different.
That's a path.
That's a path. It is. And it's one that we all walk alone. So for me, much of my research for 10 years was about difference and diversity. And organizational cultural competency. That was the kind of stuff I did at university for lots of years.
Okay.
And toward the end of my research, one of the things I began to think about more is that diversity really has nothing to do with other people. I began to start writing about diversity is really about me and who I see as similar from me and who I see as different from me.
Hmm.
And that distinction is really happening in my head, in my heart, and in my mind. It really has nothing to do with the other person. So that series of thoughts invited me to really think about how my sense of purpose in the world then impacts what I see as diversity and difference and cultural competency, and as a result of that, this notion of beyond self-help becomes a piece of work that invites us to take stock of ourselves. What I've decided is to allow the perfect people to do the judging. The rest of us accept that we're works in progress and just work on our chief responsibility is to work on being a better us.
There's a question that you ask early on, which is a really interesting question. It comes from the overarching concept of how do I identify myself to me.
Mm-hmm. Indeed.
And you have then a list of questions to help folks get at that. And it was really interesting to see you ask, what do you enjoy doing alone?
Mm.
When do you do it? And why do you like doing it? Talk about that a little bit more.
I think that's important for one central reason, that joy, the joy that we experience, that we share, that we feel in the world, really starts from within us. And so that activity, that series of questions, is really designed for us to find the joy in our life. And then once we find that joy, that's the joy we go share with our children, with our mates, with the world, with our community, with our families. Because when we don't have a sense of joy that comes from within, we begin to start looking for that in other places, which requires us to develop appetites and ideas and desires that ultimately can't be fulfilled, and the desire to fulfill them leaves us empty and unfulfilled as a result.
Hmm.
So that's why that particular set of questions, to me, is fundamental to this notion of this journey to be better, going beyond self-help, because this idea is identifying who the self is in the equation.
And, you know, one of the things that strikes me about that question is, as valuable as it is for someone who sees themselves as older to really ask that question, it's critically important for someone who sees themselves as younger to ask the very same question.
Absolutely. I agree. And it could be for different reasons.
Right.
And life has this way, you know, we've got these plans, and then life has this way of happening. Like, so for me, I was married 15 years, and I went through a divorce. And during the divorce, what I did was I assigned a lot of my energy to explaining why my ex was doing what my ex was doing.
Which was all terrible, I'm sure.
Right, at least from my point of view.
Yeah.
This is my point.
Right.
You'll see my point in a second. So that gave me permission to do two things that I actually didn't have permission to do. One is, it gave me permission to not focus on my own behavior and what I did do to contribute to the divorce.
Right.
So, because as long as I can assign responsibility to her, it gave me permission to not do my own work.
Right.
And that then hurts my opportunity to grow. The second thing, though, that's important is for me to understand that I am a full participant in my life. That everything that happens in my reality, I in some way, some fashion, have contributed to that circumstance as part of my reality. And that empowers me to orient myself to my world in a completely different way. And beyond self-help is an opportunity for us to engage in a series of questions that invites us to be fully present.
In being fully present, there are several questions that you ask. You know, for some folks, I think the idea of being fully present is maybe kind of scary. Maybe
absolutely.
You don't really want to. You know, maybe you want to be somewhere else all the time. So, what do you say to those folks who are saying, you know, I'd rather watch cement dry than be fully present?
And that becomes like that's. I think that that's a question that divides us. Those of us who are willing to do the work to get better, and those of us who are simply willing to pay lip service to it. Mm. I think that it's very easy for us to say to judge another group of people. For example, if coming from a religious point of view to say, you know, what's a sin, homosexuality is a sin, I think it's easy for us to make those sort of judgments on other people. But what is more difficult for us to do is to be fully accountable and present to the way we treat the strangers in the grocery store.
Gotcha.
To the way we treat the folks who cut us off in traffic. That's the real work. And because it requires so much more of our energy, I think that we unconsciously don't do it because we don't want, we want the outcome, but we don't want the work to get there.
Indeed. And you know, I would suggest that we are kind of living in, is it a time, is it a country, I don't know, is it a human condition where people really want outcomes, but they rarely want to do the work to get the outcome that they truly want, which actually could be different from the outcome they say they want.
Absolutely. In fact, there's a chapter in my book that says, there's a chapter in the book that talks about what I call, it's called The Essence of Existence Itself,
mm-hmm.
Relationship. And in that chapter, it makes the argument that before we are in relationship with any other human being, we are first in relationship with ourselves.
Right.
With our ideas, hopes, dreams, failures, and however we construct an identity out of that, that becomes what we relate to, what we relate with other people, with our children, with our mates, with our friends, with the world. And part of that's what we call real, and the book makes a difference between what's real and what's imagined. And the notion that every part of our life has both real and imagined in it.
Mm.
For example, our past is not just what happened.
Right.
Our past is our past is also what we believe what happened meant.
Exactly.
And our past is also what, not just what we believe what happened, what that meant, but our past is also what we believe we could have done differently that would have made the event different, which would have impacted who we are today. Our past also includes that. Is that real or is that imagined?
Right.
I don't feel qualified to answer that, but in any event, it is a part of the way in which we relate to one another. And if we're not willing to own our own identity, then how can we invite anybody else to do so?
One of the things that you ask, that the reader ask of him or herself, is whether or not their choices are a reflection of the individual, or talk about that. Am I my choices?
Choices, or are my choices a reflection of me?
Right. What does that mean? What do you want people to consider?
There's this complicated relationship between our circumstances. And there are people who will make the argument that we are our circumstances. So, for example, when I was a teacher, and I go into, and I often went to kids' houses because of that story I told you about Mr. Rubens. I went to
yes.
lots of kids' houses because of that. And I go in the house, and the kids, there's drugs in the house. There's all kinds of things that kids shouldn't be around.
Mm-hmm.
And so there are ideas that we can have about the choices that folks are making in that house and the choices the kids are making. But the fact of the matter is there's lots of kids who come from those circumstances who do absolutely fine. And there are lots of kids who come from two-parent households living in suburbs
right.
who completely fall off the cliff.
Right.
Right. And so I don't know that our choices are that it's too simplistic just to say that we
right.
are the result of our choices.
Right.
Right, because I think that even when we make bad choices, there's still opportunities for goodness to come out of them. Simultaneously, I don't think that that not examining how we make our choices is
mm-hmm.
something we should avoid either. Because the way we make decisions, the choices that we make, does indicate something about us to ourselves. And so that chapter invites us to find the space between those two things. And I think that there's more space or less space there than we might think going in.
You know, oftentimes in my office, I will ask someone how they know that whatever this thing is that they want, how will they know that they've achieved it? And it's really interesting how many people have to sort of stop and think about that, because
mm-hmm.
the idea of thinking about how you think about things is really kind of unique for many people.
And there's no place. There's no place that helps us do that.
Right.
School doesn't do that. I mean, church doesn't necessarily do that. There's no place where we learn how to examine the patterns of our thinking and how those patterns contribute to things that are happening in our lives. We tend to experience very similar challenges over and over and over again, in part because the pattern of thinking that we have keeps leading us to the same set of choices.
Indeed. Folks, you are listening to Dr. Eric Johnson, who is the author of Beyond Self-Help. We are going to take a break, and when we come back, Dr. Johnson, I'd like to talk about your sense of the responsibility we have to ourselves. Hello, folks. I continue the conversation with Dr. Eric Johnson, who is the author of Beyond Self-Help, The Journey to Be Better. Dr. Johnson, why is it important to think about the responsibility that you have towards yourself? Is it important? Is it possible?
Well, I think it's important in part because what we talked about earlier is that I think that we are first in relationship with ourselves. And whatever the relationship we have with ourselves then becomes the basis upon which we relate to other people. And so the responsibility we have with ourselves then becomes the responsibility we have is to get to know and grow ourselves, because we are the only people who can do that. And in part, the absence of growth is a marker of death. Mm-hmm. I mean, growth is a fundamental aspect of the way in which we define life.
Sure.
And so the responsibility we have to ourselves, that's a chapter in the book, because it is us identifying who we are to ourselves and then using our experiences in the world as a mechanism to validate, modify, and express our sense of purpose and our way of being in the world.
I know, Dr. Johnson, that there are at least a couple of people who are saying to themselves, all of this talk about paying attention to myself and responsibility to myself, this is all nonsense. I need to think outside of myself and pay attention to other people. I don't want to be so self-centered.
I would agree with anybody who said that, and I don't think my work does that. I think that our work allows us to use the journey to ourselves as a way to relate to other people.
Okay.
Because I would agree. In fact, my next book is called it's coming out January 1st, called 10 Deadly Aspects of Pride, where I explore that notion with a little more detail and specificity. But that's a notion I would agree with.
So the idea that I am responsible for my own growth, well, doesn't that mean that I don't get to blame anybody for it? I got to do it myself.
Unfortunately, that's our deal. And when we claim we want to grow, then the question becomes: do we bring people in our space, in our lives, that challenge our way of being? And when we are forced to confront our way of being, when our way of being is confronted, what do we tend to do? Do we tend to try to rationalize our worldview, or do we seek to understand the limitations of our knowledge? Seek to understand the limitations of our understanding. And when we do that, when we seek to understand the limitations of our understanding, those are opportunities for us to know more than what we know in a particular moment. If all we seek to do when we're confronted with alternative ways of being or with when our notions of being are challenged, if all we seek to do is rationalize our way of being, then I don't know that ever invites us to be more or to grow.
It sounds like you're saying that it's almost our job. In fact, I think you're saying it is our job to grow and to pay attention to ourselves in really honest and significant ways in order to be better ourselves, in order to be better in the world around us.
For us to be better mothers, fathers, husbands, wives, spirits, and human beings, fundamentally, the fundamental component to that is us being clear about who we are, what we want, and what we strive to be. I think that this understanding the self is different from being self-centered, and I think that much of what happens in the world when we don't do the work about self, we develop these insatiable appetites of material-driven things that have no relationship to our sense of purpose.
Mm.
How much money we make, the houses that we live in, the cars that we drive. Now, don't get me wrong; those things are good. It's okay to have nice houses, nice cars, but that can't be the end-all, be-all, because if that's true, then the drug dealers are winning.
Okay. That can't be your definition of your self-worth.
The It can't. If that's the deal, then all the people who have accomplished that in ways that we find negatively impact the human experience, they're all winning.
Well, we don't want that. We say we don't want that.
We don't want that. That's the point. So hopefully that section forces us to confront what we mean by that.
Right.
Not just us as individuals, but us as a society. Because the thing, Dr. Brewer, is that sometimes when we teach our children the wrong lessons, they learn them.
I think all the time.
Right. So if we teach them to incorporate material accumulation as part of their life's mission, they will do that. And they will be less for it.
If we teach our children to make judgments based on the appearance of others, they learn that as well.
They absolutely learn that. Indeed.
So just to go back to the issue of the lack of safety on the streets, if you will, for people of color, for people who look different, for people who behave in a different way, when we teach our children, when we take it in ourselves and teach our children that anybody who's different is bad, we're really teaching them, and they're really learning it, and they're really learning it.
Absolutely. And that's why, for me, the whole issue with Ferguson, and I mean, while we can identify that particular municipal, that's happening across the country.
Right.
One of the things that we have to do is once the protests stop, and I participated in many of those, some in D.C., some of the marches. I went to Missouri. I'm doing some workshops out in some schools out there. But once we leave the streets, we're still left with the unit that's at home, and that's where our work is.
The importance of the unit at home, there are some folks who will say, if I don't have a home, if I don't have food to eat, if when I walk outside of my door, I run the risk of being shot, or I believe I run the risk of being shot, how can I focus on my home? What do you say to them?
I think that's a complicated stuff, and I don't want to be positioned to be able to explain everything in the world, right? I think that those are issues that we all have to resolve, and those are meaningful issues because I myself have experienced that.
Okay.
But I also think though that it's never irrelevant, even under those circumstances, for us to say, okay, what part of this reality do I control?
Okay.
What part of this reality can I impact? And then take our energy and laser focus it there. Because under those circumstances, you could begin to start worrying about a whole host of things that do matter,
right,
but you can't do anything about them.
Exactly.
And what we want to do is take that energy and put it someplace where we can actually make a difference. Not in the world, not in the community, but in our own individual lives, with our children, with our families. Take our energy and under those circumstances and say, what piece of this can I do? And that's what I would say to those folks.
Which is really where it begins.
It has to be. So, for example, one of the things that changed for me, that changed my life, was when I began to see my life in terms of the opportunities rather than the challenges.
Mm. And that's a huge shift, because so many people see it as they're just challenges, and it's just one challenge after another, and you get tired of challenges.
Absolutely. So when my daughter asked me to come into the DMV area with her from Colorado, and I did without clear, I didn't do a one-to-one, take this job, come this job. I said, this is the opportunity for me to finish my book, for me to really, really put some energy into my consulting, and that doesn't mean that all of the other challenges didn't have space in my life, but I saw the opportunity that it presented, and that's what I did, and lo and behold, one book's published, another one's on the way.
There is so much power in shifting how you think about how you think. I mean, that's just the bottom line. You say that love informs our identity. What do you mean by that?
So in that chapter, that chapter, there's a chapter called The Difference Between Love and Nice. And in that section, there's a section that talks about how love informs our identity. And when we are children, as young people, love communicates notions of stability, worth, security, development, trust, and when those notions are interrupted, when a development is delayed, then it has impacts for us as adults. Mm. We don't love and trust and secure in our own vulnerabilities, because when we're young, love communicates to us that we are worthy as is.
Okay.
And so how love informs our identity, to the extent that we have distance in the space of what we think about love, that impacts the way we share, the way we understand love in our relationships. And I don't just mean romantic relationships. I mean the way we love our children, the way we love ourselves, the way we say we love our God, the way in which love operates in our world is in part informing what we think, what and who we think we are.
Folks, you have been listening to the voice of Dr. Eric Johnson, who is the author of Beyond Self-Help, The Journey to Be Better. Dr. Johnson, are there ways that people can get more information about your book?
Sure. So certainly the book is on Amazon.com. It's on BarnesNoble.com. The book has a Facebook page, Beyond Self-Help. And if they go to the Facebook page, they can actually get the book they can get information about the book, and they can actually purchase the book there if they want to. But we've got several book talks scheduled around the DMV area, and folks can look out for more information about that.
Okay, and for those who are unaware, DMV is District of Columbia, Maryland, and Virginia.
Indeed, I should have known to say that.
Okay, well, you're forgiven. Thank you so much, Dr. Johnson, for spending time with us today.
Thank you.
Folks, Mind Talk is provided daily as an educational public service, and it is not intended to replace the treatment with a licensed medical or mental health professional. If you would like to be in touch with me directly, that number is 301-654-5286. That's 301-654-5286. For more information about Mind Talk, remember that you can go to mindtalk.org. Again, that's mindtalk.org. You can also listen to Mind Talk on demand 24/7 also at mindtalk.org. The managing producer is Jim Brown and 26x2 Communications. And folks, remember, I know you got to remember this. If it's unacceptable, it's unacceptable. You take care.